listening to By the Well, a lectionary-based podcast for preachers recorded on the land of the Wurundjeri people.
Hi, I'm Sally Douglas.
And I'm Robin Whittaker.
And this is Pentecost Week 12. And in By the Well this week, we're going to be focusing on Jeremiah 2, 4 to 13, and Luke 14, verse 1 and then 7 to 14. And we might just dive into a tiny bit of Hebrews if we get time, Hebrews 13. It's great to be with you.
Yeah, you too, Sally. Let's get into Jeremiah.
Yeah, sure. So you've talked about it a little bit, giving some context in earlier weeks.
Yes, yeah. Last week with Howard Wallace gave us some context. So if you want to preach on Jeremiah and that would be helpful, you could perhaps listen to last week's episode too. This passage starts in verse 4, but it's helpful to read from the beginning of the chapter because it's framed as God sort of recalling the love between God and Israel, and it's framed as covenantal or bridal love. So this use of a marriage metaphor, which we get in a lot of the prophets.
Yeah.
But it's an image of like mutual love, covenant.
Deeply relational,
and we're going to see that echoed in the passage. So one of the things that really struck me is right at the beginning of verse 5 where God asks a profoundly vulnerable question. It's kind of shockingly so in the mouth of God. What wrong did your ancestors find in me that they grew distant?
It's incredible,
like,
isn't it?
Yeah, like, yeah.
I think it challenges notions that are kind of in the ether, you know, in art galleries or in philosophy or just in the general view of God as static and aloof or so. But so often the biblical text, that's not at all how God is imaged. God is deeply relational and vulnerable. I mean, obviously for Christians, utter vulnerability in coming among us in human form. But in this ancient Jewish text, God is wounded, saying, what have I done wrong? What did I do?
Yeah, what have I done wrong that you've walked away from me?
Yeah.
And again, it's not the only time we find this. Micah 6, which is quite a well-known passage for its justice, mercy parts, but it starts in the same way with a question about, you know, what wrong have I done that you would walk away from me? So there's this sense that comes through of kind of lament from the Godhead of, you know, I've given you the gifts. I brought you out of Egypt. I gave you freedom. I gave you a plentiful land. I nourished you and you've still kind of walked away and abandoned me.
Yeah. And abandoned me for these false, like not life-giving idols, these false gods.
Yeah.
So this sense of you're going to try and find a better partner, like a better deal. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. You looked elsewhere.
Yeah.
What did you notice, Sally?
Well, that struck me too, that vulnerability of God. But alongside that, I think there's the most incredible verse in verse 6 where then God says, they did not say, where is the Lord who brought us up from the land of Egypt? So this, not only is God lamenting that people have walked away, but God's lamenting that they haven't expressed a seeking for God. That's incredible. So I think often we can think, unfortunately, because I really don't think it's faithful at all, but unfortunately people have somehow heard the message that if they have doubts or they're not sure where God is anymore, that somehow means they're not being faithful.
That's a lack of faith to say, where is God?
Yeah, correct. Yep. Whereas if we read passages like this and then the Psalms are full of lament, going, God, where are you? Seriously, I've drenched my pillows. I don't know where you are. I'm drenched my pillow with tears. But to hear from the voice of God in this passage, God saying, why didn't you ask?
Like, why didn't you reach out kind of thing? It's almost like, yes.
So I love that imagery.
So you could play with both those things there and about the way that, I mean, obviously there's lots of human parallels about the way any good relationship is reliant on both parties reaching out to each other. And we're going to see this, I mean, to nod ahead to the Hebrews reading, which we're not going to discuss in detail, but there's that thing of mutual love, which is primarily framed as between believers as an ethical thing in the community, but it's based on the mutual love of God and God's people.
And extends to strangers as well.
So, yes.
Yeah. So this sense, I feels like if you were going to go with this passage to explore the place of the notion of God as vulnerable and longing to be in relationship with. You could also explore, because, this is not just a story about ancient Israel. Like, we continue to make idols.
Yeah.
And so whether it's not sure that God's going to come up with the good, so we'll try and push ahead on our own agenda, or, worshipping in inverted commas our status on social media, or, you know, putting our confidence in things other than God, our reputation, whatever it is, our achievements, that invitation to become aware of, are we returning to the one who is the source of our nourishment? And when we are experiencing the absence of God, to know that that isn't faithlessness, it's part of faith. It's
part of a journey of faith, and actually reaching out and kind of... Yeah, you're right. I think we're taught to pray politely in some kind of way.
We really are.
Instead of being like, God, where are you? I'm kind of angry right now because I'm struggling and you don't seem to be here.
Yeah,
like
that's, exactly.
That's a relationship to reach out like that.
And I think preachers and worship leaders, lay or ordained, have a real responsibility to create opportunities for that or to model that. So whether it's in choosing to use some of the Psalms of laments as call and response in worship, just so that people have some words that they can borrow if they don't want to say it out loud themselves in case it feels rude. It's like, well, I'm quoting scripture here.
That's right.
Yep. My God, why have you forsaken me?
Yep.
So to know that God is longing, God would rather us be saying, where are you, than just walking away completely.
Yes. And, I mean, that thing you've pointed out in verse 6, it's repeated again. I mean, so it's the people did not say, and then in verse 8, I think it is, the priests did not say. So even the leaders, you know, they didn't ask, where is the Lord, what's going on here? They've, you know, abandoned again their faith in God and they've turned to other gods.
Yeah.
And this all comes to a head. I mean, verse 13 really, in a sense, summarizes this reading and in many ways the main critique of most prophetic literature. You know, this two evils my people have done. They've forsaken me, the source of living waters, which is a beautiful image for God, and of course one we get picked up by Jesus in the New Testament. And they've made for themselves cisterns, broken cisterns at that, that cannot hold water. And I mean, there's probably a reference there to very real, elaborate, you know, you live in a water scarce culture, you had to create water storage things and they dug into the earth and lined it and created ways to store water and grain safely. Except they are broken here, and there's a sense that you had the source of living water and you relied on your own human technology because you turned away from it. And I just wonder, for preachers, there's a way to pick up that metaphor, because it is a metaphor, and think about, what are the ways that we rely on ourselves, our technologies, you know, our skills, a whole lot of very human devised things, and all of those things are wonderful gifts of God.
Absolutely.
But we rely on them and turn away from the source of our life and nourishment, which is God.
Like, absolutely. So even in thinking about worship preparation, people can be tempted to go straight, you know, to this podcast or straight to the internet or straight to a commentary, where I would argue the very first thing that we're all called to do if we're being given the privilege to lead worship is to read all four lectionary readings and then shut up. Like sit and pray.
Yeah, and
like, what do you want me to say to these people this week? Mm. Then read the commentaries, then listen to the podcast, then do all the research. But start with God and let God do her work first.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. If we're just filling the spaces with all those resources, we're not letting the voice of God in.
No.
And and it is the reliant on other stuff. And of course, here this the classic Jewish sort of almost central cry of Judaism, the Shema, the Hero Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. So this is framed as Hero Israel, this entire passage, hear the word of the Lord. You know, love the Lord your God with all your heart. And in a sense, that is exactly what has been broken here.
Yeah.
They've turned away from loving God and found other things. So there's a lot to play with when you actually do unpack what might seem like some quite ancient and strange language, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And in our culture that that often favours either pretending that everything is awesome or just walking away, like to have this invitation to be able to say, it's not awesome right now, don't know what's going on, but to stay in relationship and to, you know, to wrestle with God in that.
And have the real conversation about,
powerful.
We ready to move on to Luke?
Yeah, let's do that.
So Luke 14, and the lectionary gives us verse 1, which really just gives us some context about it's the Sabbath day.
And it's in a house.
It's in a house, one of the Pharisees' houses. And Jesus is the guest, so all of that's going to kind of be important context.
It is. He's a pretty bolshy guest.
He has opinions. Yeah. He wouldn't be an easy guest.
So yes. In that context, Jesus noticed how the guests choose places of honour, which is really interesting. So let's talk a little. It's not exactly the same as us getting around a table and having pizza all together. So meals in the ancient world are quite a different thing.
Yep. Highly stratified. It might be if you watch a Downton Abbey or where there's very much the seats closest to the host are the seats of honour, and it'd go down the table on gender, who you're married to, wealth, status in the community.
And some would never get a seat in that space or a reclining spot in that space.
And, the servants or slaves would never eat at the table in some contexts, these kind of meals, perhaps, or symposiums in the Greco-Roman world, would be male-only spaces.
That's right.
So you're excluded on multiple
levels.
Here, if it's hosted by Pharisees, this is probably an exclusively Jewish group.
So it's quite a privilege to Jesus that he's being invited into this setting within the context of people thinking he potentially might be crazy or out. You know, like there's a lot of noise going on about Jesus at the moment. And so this leader, this person with some religious authority, has done the hospitable thing and invited Jesus over.
Yep. Which suggests, there is this verse at the beginning and they're watching him closely. So there's still like the jury's out. They're still trying to work out where he sits. But he's important enough as a Jewish leader.
Yeah.
That they've invited him into the space.
Yeah, so it's
like is he with us? Is he against us? We're not too sure just yet.
Which is fair.
He's one of us, maybe.
Yeah.
And
so instead of sitting down and going, awesome, I'm so glad you've invited me, Jesus starts critiquing how everyone else is behaving, which is, keeping it real.
And he critiques both, right? He's critiquing the guests for picking their places of honour, wanting to be near the host, and then he'll have a word to the hosts about what they should do should move up the lowly and...
Yeah, when you give a lunch or dinner, do not invite friends or your brothers. Imagine how awkward that was as Jesus is saying that and they're all looking at each other. When you give a lunch or dinner, do not invite your friends or your brothers or your relatives or rich neighbours in case they might invite you in return and you'd be repaid. But when you give a banquet, it's a really interesting group of people because the people often deemed unclean, not all, but invite the poor, the crippled, the lame and the blind.
Yeah. Yep.
So complete disruption of expectations about who should be at the table.
Yes. And, of course, in Luke we need to remember Luke has a lot of meals. Meal scenes are really important in Luke's gospel. And they're usually moments for teaching about the kingdom or they're revealing something about the nature of the kingdom. So this is less about, Jesus is in a sense is using what people would recognise as social norms around table manners and guest host status. Yeah. But it's less about that in some ways and more about what the kingdom should look like, which is actually this radical, far more radical opening up.
Absolutely.
That cuts across status.
Yeah, and so it's a really disruptive grace. It's not just grace that makes us all feel great. It's like, oh, my goodness, I have to see this person who I've seen as excluded or secondary to actually see them as equal, for some people to even imagine that equal and worthy of invitation and actually an imperative to invite, like that's a massive disruption of expectations.
And we know early Christian communities tried to do this, right?
Yeah, so this is what I love. So I just think it's really hard for us to get our heads around it, I think. But when Paul and others make claims about, in Christ there is no male or female and Jew or Greek and slave and free, like these are radical claims. And then they're trying to do that in their meals together. So worship is in houses. You can imagine kids running around, dogs.
They would eat a meal of some kind.
So slaves actually receiving the same food as free people and women and men. I mean,
and Jew and Gentile.
Jew and Gentile and children. Like it's astonishing. But we get to see it failing completely in Corinthians where some people are getting drunk, Paul says.
Yeah.
And some people are getting nothing. Like it's hard.
Yes, it's hard to actually share, particularly when you're the people with the status and privilege who are used to being served, right?
Yeah, and like, it's like, why didn't you bring your own? We've brought ours. I'm assuming that kind of stuff's going on. It's like, we don't have anything to bring. So this... the costly nature of it, but also the something I've been thinking about a lot recently is how astonishing in Christian tradition that hospitality is so central, but we're called into it, like not just to believe something about it or sing about it or whatever. But we're in, like, so for example, in Holy Communion, but not only in Communion, we're called to be participants of this disclosure of who and how God is. So Jesus says, you know, I am the bread and I'll feed you. So unlike all the Greco-Roman gods who you need to take food offerings to
them.
So Jesus first inverts that, but then says, keep doing this. Like, so this invitation, because it's going to take us years and our whole lifetime to get our head around the fact that we don't have to prove our worth to this God one, like that we can come with empty hands. So it's what a gift that it's this ongoing practice that we have about finding ourselves all of a sudden in this ancient story as participants and being fed. And then what that then means for how we have hospitality when it's not Holy Communion. So in communion but also in other practices.
Yeah.
How do we – like, what if hospitality, like Jesus is talking about here, isn't a side add-on to our Christian discipleship, but what if it is one of the core ways in which we embody the kingdom among us?
Yeah.
Like, actually embody it. And so that we invite people to the table or we go to their table, like, we, you know.
Yes.
We become guests. So it's not just about us having the power as the host or whatever, but we open ourselves up and eat other people's food or offer our own, and not to solve them or fix others, but to celebrate this is the character of the king. This is the texture of the kingdom.
That's right. And, I mean, I think this passage does invite us to explore some of those layers and power dynamics and roles in our own congregations and communities. So, you know, who thinks of themselves, if you hear this passage, we could ask our congregation, who thinks of themselves as the guest at the table and where might you sit? Are you the person hiding in the back who – whose voice we rarely hear?
Yes.
You might be a bit passive in the space, maybe for all sorts of reasons, but, you know, maybe don't feel like
you've only been here 5 years, so you're still the new
that's
person.
Right.
You know,
yeah,
rather
that's
than
right.
actually, my kind of view is if you've been here 3 weeks, can you please welcome that new person who just came this morning?
Yes, that's, you know, that's right.
You're here. You've been here.
But, yeah, and yes, and what you're saying goes to, like, you know, how we honour the person who's been there serving faithfully for 30 years, but it means they get a platform and maybe a louder voice, and this is disrupting all of those dynamics.
Oh,
so it's not just about the meal table, but again, the meal table is a metaphor for who's guest, who's host. And if you're the host, which is quite frankly anyone who's been in our churches more than a few weeks, it's your job to go and exalt the lowly, not hold on to the power you have.
Oh, I completely agree. And, look, I take this quite seriously, even, like, in so it's a presbytery context or a synod context. I'll look around and go, who's being ignored at morning tea?
Yes.
Go and talk to that person.
Because we go talk to the – and it's human.
It is.
And it's easy, and as an introvert, I hate small talk over cuppas, so I will go talk to the person I know. It takes enormous effort.
It does.
I will acknowledge it.
And if you don't
see
friends after, you know, for a huge amount of time, and then you can send them.
But who actually, are we leaving out because they didn't train with us, or they're not in our social circle, or they're there's all sorts of – they're not our ethnic group, right?
So I think that challenge to continue to look for who we're excluding and how we can bring them up to the top table, or, you know, metaphorically, I think it's really important stuff.
It is. And I want to say something else about Luke, but again, there's a connection here to the Hebrews reading with, you know, part of the, you know, at the end of Hebrews, we're getting these exhortations to kind of what this all means.
Yeah.
And in verse 2 there, do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers.
Because
some have entertained angels unknowingly, you know.
I love that.
Like, it's a little reminder that there is that image of God in everyone and
it you really know, is. And so, you know, this author or these authors could be referring to Abraham or, you know, others. But I think also, I mean, it's so interesting that in Matthew we have this exhortation to care for the stranger because then you're caring for me. Like, it seems like a really strong connection. And so as part of that, so it really, again, disrupts the notion of being paternalistic, like, poor you, let me bring you up to the top table, because you might meet an angel who changes your life.
That's right.
You know?
Yes.
Like, prepared to be amazed.
Yeah. That's right. That guest that you might think you're – and that's why the host-guest power dynamic is so important, because it can be paternal.
Yeah.
And it can be a way of holding on to control.
Correct.
Whereas – actually, if we let ourselves be guests and other people be hosts, we might actually recognize the way they minister to us. So it breaks down all those problematic dynamics around charity and, you know,
It really does.
Because it's mutual love is the language here, right? Not one-way love, not paternalistic love, mutual love.
Amen. And if we're meeting Christ in the stranger, as Matthew talks about, well, we better prepare to be listening and see what Christ is saying to us, you know, through these people. So it's a really astonishing dynamic we're invited into, that sense of the kingdom, which is so disruptive to the ways in which power dynamics often happen in our culture.
Mm.
Yeah.
So I want to ask you, Sel, in our last couple of minutes, what you might preach this week on these passages. One of the things, if we go big picture with Luke, that really struck me revisiting this, and I have to say the first time I read through this parable, I was like, oh, yeah, you know, is there much to say?
Yeah.
And then the more I thought about it, I'm like, this exalting of the humble and the humbling of the exalted is such a theological theme in Luke. Mm. We get it in Mary's Magnificat as this is the reason for the incarnation.
Yeah.
Christ is coming to disrupt the world order.
Yeah.
It will be repeated almost word for word in chapter 18 again. So, and then even in the cross in Luke's gospel, there is a sense that Jesus dies the innocent man and he's, I think in Luke, his divinity is truly recognized actually when he's resurrected and exalted.
Yeah. Yep.
So there is a sense that in the exaltation of the man who was ultimately humbled.
Yes, shamed.
That again embodies this flipping of kingdom values. And I mean, it maps onto everything we've just said, but I guess I'd want to give some theological framing. And if you're in a small church where you know, where you have good relationships with people, you could even play with this. You could invite people to just shift their seats.
Yeah, you could. You could.
Right? Just what's it like experiencing, like, come up, sit in the elders' chairs if you have those at the front of your church.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
Or even, so just thinking about that, years ago at Richmond, newer people were starting to come. And so at an elders meeting, we were talking about how to make sure we were really welcoming. And one of the elders suggested, I think the elders should sit in a different place every week.
Yes.
And so it was an actual practice of hospitality so that
To move
so that they could sit near where people, you know, how people often sit at the back if they've come
near.
Yeah. Or also just to shift any kind of habit of, I always sit in that chair, and so people are afraid of sitting in the wrong chair.
That leads to a sense of ownership, right?
That's
I can't sit in that pew because that's
kind of
where
an intentional practice.
That's great.
Yeah, very cool.
I love it. Yeah.
Very cool. The other thing I think would be worth exploring in these COVID normal, not normal times is how do we embody hospitality when we can't in many places have morning tea or afternoon tea together? How do we embody, because feasting together is really important, I think, but how do we do that? And that we've recently reintroduced online afternoon tea.
Okay.
Because
for some community
time. Yeah, yeah. Just bring your cup to the screen and let's have that time of fellowship. It's not a favourite word. It's a lovely word, but it's kind of been made twee.
Yeah.
But time to, and it was great. We cacked ourselves and people shared big stuff and newer people came and older people came, as in newer to the community and those who've been there longer. So just trying to find ways. I mean, maybe some places are already just doing morning tea and taking the risks, but some places are not. And so how do we seek to embody this hospitality in these really weird times?
No, I think that's great. I have a few immune compromised people in my family and wider family, you know, for whom they're excluded. So if we think again about who are the humble, who are the people on the fringes who aren't even at the table because they have to self-exclude at the moment.
Exactly.
How, like, to not lose some intentionality about reaching out as part of our hospitality and expression of the kingdom.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And there are ways of, and it's not the same, but it is still, it can be really powerful still. So like online. So that, you know, to explore those with your community maybe.
Cool. Well, thank you, Sally.
Thank you.
By the Well is brought to you by Pilgrim Theological College and the Uniting Church in Australia. It's produced by Adrian Jackson. Thanks for listening.